5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Flight cleared for takeoff.
Hello, and thank you for joining us on Kentucky Caliber. I'm Jason Belcher, your host, and this week we're going to be talking about the 23rd anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th. I guess, you know, for those of us who remember the day, who remember 9/11 itself and who lived through them, every year I kind of go through this decision, like, do I want to watch the footage again this year or not? I bought, and this ought to tell you how long ago it was, I bought a DVD, or rather a CD, that has, I think CBS News made it a long time ago, but it has a lot of the original broadcast footage from 9/11 that you can watch. They put it all together into like one collection, and so you can watch that. You can fast forward it or rewind it or stop it, but usually what you see when you look at it now, if you just do a web search, you'll get like bits and pieces of it. But this is a comprehensive collection, so you can actually go through almost the entirety of the coverage. It's I think it's over 90 minutes long, so there's quite a bit of footage in there that you don't typically see just from a quick web search or a quick YouTube search, which you can still get today. And so every year I kind of go through this decision, like, do I want to watch it? Do I not on September 11th to remember? And some years I do, some years I don't. I think last year I did not. And the year before I did. This year I have watched the footage again, just as a reminder. I don't really have any rationale to explain like what the thought process is there. Why some years I watch the footage again on 9/11 to remember and some years I don't. I guess it's just more of a feeling. For whatever reason, there's just an impulse there to remember that way by watching the footage, or there's not. Anyway, so this year I did, and I started thinking, you know, as we close in on the, you know, the quarter century mark, which will be year after next from the actual event itself, that's a pretty good amount of distance in terms of time, especially for folks who live through it. And so we have kind of an opportunity as it gets further away from living memory and further back into the past, it sort of affords us the opportunity to look at it with more of a perspective than we had at the time. I mean, I remember the immediate years after 9/11, it was so, the feeling that it was so close by, the first anniversary, second anniversary, I mean, it really felt like the day itself had just gone on for that whole year. I remember in 2002, it felt like on September 11th, 2002, like it felt like that whole year had just been a continuation of 9/11. And maybe folks who remember living through it can share that experience, because it took so long initially for the actual numbers of casualties to become known. Like, if you'll recall, the first few weeks, especially the first few days, but even the first few weeks, there was a lot of speculation about how many people had actually been killed, and we didn't know. And the rescue vehicles were pouring in from all over the country, and it was on TV all the time and on the internet all the time. And we didn't know. So there were estimates, I think, as high as 10,000 from memory. And by the way, not just Ground Zero in New York, but also the Pentagon, of course. Although the efforts to clean up there and recover and rescue people were carried out much quicker, simply because of the amount of structural damage and the amount of material to go through was far less, in the Pentagon than, you know, the huge skyscrapers and lots of tons of extra concrete and steel that we had to go through in New York. But I remember thinking, you know, that whole year just felt like we had been in 9/11 for a whole year. And I don't think that feeling really stopped maybe until 2003 or a little bit after that. And it just felt like we were in one long, continuous experience, even though I know that there were plenty of other things going on in the world and everybody was going on with their life as best they could, but it still had that feeling. But looking back, you know, by the numbers, there were 2,977 people killed on 9/11 itself. Over 1,000 injured, and I don't know if there's an official number for the thousands more who suffered, you know, lifelong after effects, especially amongst the first responders, because they were exposed to toxins or toxic chemicals that had been released from the attack itself as they were there for a long, prolonged periods of time, sifting through the rubble, trying to reach what turned out to be, unfortunately, no survivors, but also to help folks from the nearby area and to just remove the debris itself after that. So I don't know if there's an official number. I know it's in the thousands. So that's a significant number of people. If you compare that to, say, Pearl Harbor, which saw a total death count of 2,403 back in December of 1941, there's some pretty important differences, though, about those numbers. First of all, Pearl Harbor, you know, there was a naval base there that was attacked, and most of those casualties, if not all, were military personnel. And that's the exact opposite, of course, of the case in 9/11, when almost every American that was killed was a civilian. And I include within that umbrella of civilian, the firefighters and police officers who tragically gave their lives trying to rescue folks who were victims of the attack itself. So almost everyone that died on American soil from the attacks of 9/11 were civilians, as opposed to Pearl Harbor, which are almost all military. Plus, Pearl Harbor is pretty distant from the mainland U.S., right? It's thousands of miles out to sea. And of course, Hawaii is a U.S. state, and nobody, you know, questioned that they were any less American than anyone else. But the fact is, it's a long way out there. It's pretty far. It's pretty distant out into the Pacific. It's smack in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. If you've never been by there or to it, it's a long way. Even by plane, it takes a while to get there. And it didn't happen. When it happened, the images of it were not broadcast live. Like, there wasn't TV coverage then, or there weren't instantaneous video footage as the attacks happened, right? So we didn't watch it happen. So when it occurred, of course, it created a huge response from the American public. It changed American opinion about whether or not we should enter World War II. Before that, we were actually very divided. The public was actually split almost 50-50 about whether or not we should get in or get involved in the Second World War. The Pearl Harbor attack, of course, changed that overnight. And public sentiment overwhelmingly moved in favor of getting involved. And it motivated, you know, millions to come and join the military. Even though they were drafted, they still showed up without any reservations. And so millions joined the military. Public sentiment was shifted. So, of course, Pearl Harbor had a huge impact. But it was a different kind of impact than the impact that 9/11 had on the American public. That one was on U.S. soil, and it was viewed live. So we did see it happen in real time. And I remember at that time, and I think we've done a couple of 9/11 shows before, so I know I've mentioned this in previous years. I was a first lieutenant at that time, assigned to the 964th Airborne Air Control Squadron at Tinker Air Force Base, which is out in Oklahoma City. And I remember that morning, you know, it was pretty much like before we knew what had happened, we were just busy doing our work that we had for the day, like every other day. And I remember, later on, we had my commander in his office, because I worked right next to his office as his exec, and he had a small VCR in there, and he'd recorded some of the footage, and he brought in a couple of our pilots from A flight. So the squadron was divided up into different flights. A flight was flight deck, so those were the pilots and navigators. And so he brought in a couple of our best pilots to watch the footage, and I remember they looked at him and they said, "Oh yeah, there's no question about it, sir. That was intentional." And the commander looked at the other pilot and he said, "Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it." So, you know, it was pretty clear from the outset that even though those were civilian planes that were flown into the Twin Towers and into the Pentagon, it was done on purpose. It wasn't a navigational error or an engine failure or anything like that. It was pretty clear immediately that it was intentional. And it didn't take the authorities long or law enforcement and intelligence apparatus to put piece together by looking at the manifest, the list of passengers, who was on there and which ones had ties to terrorist groups. And of course, it wasn't long after that until the leader of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, you know, claimed credit for the attack, which is what they wanted. That was part of their strategy to attack the United States and then take credit for it. Their initial reasoning was, or their initial purpose was, they wanted, or at least bin Laden wanted, the United States to leave the Middle East. They wanted us out of that region. In subsequent years, it became popular for a lot of people to say that it was part of bin Laden's strategy to make us overreact and spend too much money or get involved in more overseas conflicts so that it would bleed the national treasury and it would deplete our resources and our credibility if we mismanaged those wars. I don't think any of that part is true. I don't think he had anything that far-reaching in terms of a strategy. What he did want was the U.S. to leave the Middle East, and of course that didn't work at all. The exact opposite happened. Our presence there has only grown, and of course we got involved in an enormously long military operation in Afghanistan. When we first started conducting combat operations in 2001, I think October was the very initial. We had special forces and some assets from the CIA on the ground, taking part in initial combat against the Taliban, who decided to give sanctuary to Al-Qaeda, the group that had actually planned the terrorist attack. By the way, the term Al-Qaeda simply means the base in Arabic. And this was a global, transnational terrorist group headed by Osama bin Laden, a wealthy Saudi. I think he made his family had made their fortune in the construction business, and he had inherited a lot of it, and he used his share to help finance operations by his group, by his terrorist group around the world. There had been many other attacks before 9/11 leading up to that, but that was certainly their biggest attack that they'd ever successfully carried out, and the group claimed credit for it. So it wasn't a mystery. It didn't take us too long to figure out what had happened and who was responsible for it. And so that led to an enormous military operation and a shift in our strategy, I should say. That's really the most important part. And I remember when then President George W. Bush, who was president at the time, he said something in 2001. I think it was when he addressed Congress, and this was the first major address he gave after 9/11. So I don't remember the exact date on this, but he said, "We shall make no distinctions between the terrorists who attacked us and those who harbor them." And of course, at the time, many people applauded that and greeted that as if it were a wise decision. Well, it was certainly our rights and our responsibility to retaliate against those who had attacked us. I mean, we had just been attacked by viciously attacked by a serious enemy, and that called for a military response. So there's no question we were within our rights to retaliate with military force against Al-Qaeda. But this part of the strategy was very problematic, and I think it indeed turned out to be the fatal flaw, because it was applied not just in Afghanistan but almost everywhere. What we needed to successfully prosecute a war on terrorist groups was to make precisely that distinction, because it does matter. There is a difference between countries or groups or places or people who are harboring terrorists from those who are actually carrying out terrorist attacks or funding, financing, and training for them. There is a difference. And I think had we recognized that and had we used that in our strategy, in our strategic mindset from the beginning, I think it's likely that our chances of success would have been greater. In this sense, specifically, because we were of the mindset that we're going to make no distinction between terrorist groups and those who harbored them, that made it very easy to carry out more and more attacks in more and more places. And I think that includes the Iraq War, which, of course, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. We know that. Saddam, for all his, of course, he was a bad guy. Of course, he was an evil guy. He was an evil ruler. Nobody questions that. I don't. But he was a secular ruler. He wasn't an Islamist. He wasn't part of their network of jihadists. In fact, during Saddam's rule, they were enemies, and he arrested quite a few of those. I think his foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, made a statement one time, and, you know, they don't always, they didn't very often tell the truth. They kind of made a slip on this one because I think they were bragging about it. But he said in a press conference once, he said, "Well, if there's any members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the only place they could be is in prison, because we arrest those guys." And they did, because they were enemies. So Saddam had almost nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, and it's the government of the United States and our leadership at the time lied to the American people straight up that there was a connection between those two that they used as the basis for the Iraq War, which unfortunately was a catastrophe in almost every sense of the word. I was there. I served in Iraq. I saw it. what I saw of it, I didn't see the whole thing, but what I saw of it was a catastrophe. It was just an unmitigated chaos and just madness. And my perspective, having been there, even at the time as a captain who just got promoted to major or got selected for promotion to major, I looked around and I just thought this makes no sense. This is insane. Like, what's going on here? I don't see what this has to do with protecting or the United States or furthering our security interests. I don't see it. It was just chaos. And so we ended up spending enormous amounts of blood and treasure in Iraq, which diverted us from our original objective, which was to find and eliminate the terrorist group Al-Qaeda, which had carried out the 9/11 attacks. How much did we spend in Iraq and Afghanistan total? I mean, I think there's still some debate about that. There's a lot of estimates, and they have a pretty wide range of variation. There's a Harvard study last year, or rather in 2021, that estimated the total costs at $4 trillion. There's a Brown University study, another Ivy League institution, very credible study, that put the figure at $8 trillion, although that number includes the long-term healthcare costs of wounded veterans. Thousands of wounded veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and survived their wounds thanks in part to advances in battlefield medicine and rapid transport. So there were people wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan who survived injuries that would have been fatal in any other conflict prior to that, because we had these advances in medicine and the ability to rapidly get them from the place they were wounded to a modern medical facility. And I've actually witnessed that personally. I was on a flight as an escort from Balad, Iraq, to Ramstein, or I think we actually flew to Landstuhl, Germany. It's about a 5-hour, 6-hour flight. I can't remember. But we had everyone that had been wounded just recently was loaded onto the transport. And there was a huge team of doctors and nurses, and they were constantly going around and caring for folks, and they would just ask us to get stuff or carry stuff or do whatever they wanted, whatever help they needed. And when we got there, when we landed there at Landstuhl and or Ramstein, I can't remember which one it was. Maybe we landed at Ramstein and they bussed them over to Landstuhl. I don't remember. But when we landed, the doors opened and an even bigger team of trauma surgeons, doctors, nurses just absolutely swarmed the back. And all of those that were critically wounded were taken immediately off the plane, which had come straight from Iraq, and into a modern medical surgical treatment facility at Landstuhl, where they could receive the best that modern medicine had to offer. And that all happened in a matter of hours. So in the space of 10 hours or less than that, in some cases, combatants could go from being wounded to being back in a modern medical treatment facility, and that saved their life. It also left a lot of people alive with terrible injuries that will leave them in need of chronic health care and chronic medical care. And so those numbers are staggering too. And so the reason why the Brown University study for $8 trillion is so high, I think, is because it includes all of that health care. And they projected that out for as long as those folks are expected to live, for the next 30 years beyond the end of combat operations in Iraq or Afghanistan, when the folks who were wounded in those conflicts were still alive and receiving care at the expense of the U.S. government. So it's a huge cost in blood and treasure. So the number of people killed and wounded, and I'm only talking Americans, by the way, in Iraq and Afghanistan were far more than what we lost on 9/11 itself, and the costs were enormous. As for the number of civilians killed in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other places where we were conducting combat operations against Al-Qaeda, which includes certain portions of northern Africa and other places in Asia, I don't know what the number is, honestly. I suspect it's really high. I know there's a tendency, there's been a lot of studies done which have an axe to grind. And by that, I mean the authors of the study look to make the number as high as they possibly can or as low as they possibly can to support their own, political agendas. So whenever I see that, I think, okay, we got to take these numbers with a grain of salt. But it's huge. It's a huge amount. There's no question that they were enormous and destructive. And, of course, the Afghan, we still have, as far as I know, at least a small contingent of troops in military forces stationed in western Iraq that are involved in combat operations in Syria. Of course, we left Afghanistan in, I think, August of 2021, and the way in which we did that was a mess. I mean, it was awful. It was terrible to see, and it was terrible that it happened that way. And of course, this being a presidential election year, there's plenty of blame storming going on. You know, the Trump administration blames Biden. Vice President Harris, who's now running at the top of the ticket for the Democrats, blames the Trump administration. Me personally, I blame the Taliban for the deaths of U.S. servicemen and women in Afghanistan, because they were the ones who killed them. That's who I blame. I don't blame my political opponents. When a foreign military or foreign militants kill U.S. servicemen, I blame the people who actually did it. So I blame the Taliban. However, it's not a secret that the two administrations did a poor job of coordinating and planning for the withdrawal from Afghanistan, even though we knew it was coming. So the Trump administration set that up before he left office. They had agreed to the timetable with the Taliban, and so we knew that it was going to happen, and they did almost no planning for it. And worse than that, not only did they not do any planning for it, they stonewalled the Biden administration's transition team when they first came in. So that involves getting information, sharing of information. It wasn't done. And so it took longer than it should have. So there was a delay until the Biden finally got all his people in after he'd been sworn in, because the Trump people wouldn't tell him anything or wouldn't talk to him under Trump's orders, by the way. So that delay was costly. However, the Biden administration also knew that there was a timetable agreed for to withdraw, and they didn't do much in the way of planning either. And so even after all of that, even after the stonewalling and the delays from the Trump administration, which were purely political, by the way, his lies about him winning the 2020 election are ridiculous, and they had a negative impact. But the Biden people knew that, and they still didn't do much of a plan. They still didn't do much planning either. And so by the time it rolled around for us to actually remove the last of our forces from Afghanistan, you got what you saw, which was just a horrible spectacle that wasn't very well coordinated. You know, hats off to the folks on the ground who made the best of a chaotic and terrible situation to get out of there. It's always the pointy end of the spear that gets stuck with the responsibility with cleaning up a mess that the decision makers back in D.C. failed to account for, and that's what happened in this case. The men and women of the U.S. military did a phenomenal job of managing a situation that was terrible, and it ended up costing fatalities there towards the end. And I understand that no one wants to be the last guy to die in a conflict or the last people to die in a war, just like nobody wants to be the first. But the fact is, they were killed by the Taliban, not by the Biden administration and not by the Trump administration. Yeah, those two administrations did a pretty pitiful job of planning and coordinating and putting politics aside to try to keep in mind the big picture. They failed at that completely. But they didn't kill our servicemen and women. The Taliban did. And that's one of the things that just, when I think about 9/11 and I remember all the images and all the sounds and sights from that day, I remember that it's easy to forget who the enemy is. It's easy to forget where our enemy is. And it's easy to forget when subsequent elections took place and things got heated, and they always do. I mean, this is pretty, the fact that Trump's blaming the Biden administration and now Harris is blaming Trump, that's pretty standard presidential politics. I mean, it's not unusual. We've seen this a lot of times. But it's easy during those type of years, and elections after 9/11 were even more heated and more contested than they usually were. It's easy to forget who the enemy is, and that's the Taliban. Of course, the original reason that bin Laden planned and carried out the 9/11 attacks was to get us to leave the Middle East, which backfired. Even now, though, which brings me to another point I wanted to make. So one of the legacies of 9/11 is we have this massive government bureaucracy called the Department of Homeland Security, which did not exist prior to 9/11. DHS was the creation of President Bush as a domestic response. Initially, the thinking was sound. You know, the idea was to improve information sharing and intelligence coordination amongst our intelligence agencies and our domestic law enforcement agencies, because terrorism was both a military operation abroad and a domestic security threat at home. And so you had to have there was a law enforcement component for that. And so that part made sense, right? I mean, it made sense. But what it's ballooned into, I guess, as it almost always does, is just a massive bureaucracy. And now that Al-Qaeda has been, for the most part, eliminated or killed, and they have been, by the way, we were successful in that. It came at an insanely high cost in terms of blood and treasure and took much longer than it should have. But we did it. We did manage to eliminate them. And so after that, you've got this huge government bureaucracy now with an enormous budget and lots of resources and personnel and no enemy. And so we've seen that before in the Middle East. That's here in the United States, but we've seen that before with CENTCOM. CENTCOM is Central Command, which is the U.S. major command responsible for military operations in that part of the world. So we used to call them MAJCOMs or major commands. And what that means is that's the organizational structure of the military. There's a four-star that commands each MAJCOM. That MAJCOM, the major command that's responsible for that part of the world, is called Central Command, U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, has a four-star in charge of it. The original purpose for CENTCOM was it was established during the Cold War, again, with solid rationale, and the thought process was we need to have a way to stop the Soviets from capturing the oil fields in the Middle East should there be a war between the United States and the Soviet Union. Well, that made sense. But even after the Soviet Union had collapsed and the original purpose for CENTCOM had ceased to exist, CENTCOM not only wasn't dismantled, it got bigger. It got larger. It grew. And thank you to Professor Andrew Basevich for pointing that out in his book, The New American Militarism. He's a retired Army lieutenant colonel, and now he's a PhD that I think teaches history in Boston or at Boston U. I'm not sure if he's still there, but he used to. It's a really good book. Most of his writings are really good. I would encourage folks to read it's good work. But so you see the similarity there, right? So we have CENTCOM that was created to stop the Soviets. The Soviets cease to exist, and CENTCOM not only doesn't go away, it gets bigger. Then we have DHS, which was created to protect the United States and its citizens from the threat posed by Al-Qaeda and its affiliate groups. Well, now Al-Qaeda has been destroyed, but DHS is still getting bigger, like it's grown. Right now it's even larger. And so there's this tendency, I guess, after we face a significant threat to our national security, even after we've dealt with that threat, the organs and apparatus of government that we created to deal with them, they don't go away. They just get bigger. They just keep getting bigger and more expensive. And so that's one of the legacies here at home of September 11th. Now that we have this massive bureaucracy, which clearly hasn't stemmed the tide of or hasn't done a great job dealing with the problems at the southern border, even though that has to be solved down south. You have to solve that at the root of the problem. You can't expect to have a solution put in place there. By the time the tens of thousands or however many there are, it varies with the seasons and with events. But once the numbers of people that are coming there have already made it that far, it's too late to implement a solution. So the border problem has to be solved in Central and Latin America. You know, and I've said this in other programs, so I won't go back through all of that. But anyway, so there you have DHS, which is still responsible for coordinating information sharing and intelligence sharing, and it's there, and it's this massive bureaucracy. No one's really sure exactly what it's supposed to be doing now, except that it gets a huge chunk of the budget every year. Military spending's up too. That's another legacy, I think, of 9/11. You know, I think the defense budget annually passed $800 billion last year, which is incredible. We're well on our way to having a $1 trillion defense establishment, which would be, I think, as far as I know, a first in human history. And of course, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and now with last year's Hamas attack on Israel, there's plenty of new conflicts that may have a need for the advanced hardware and the increased resources that we've applied for it. But we applied those resources well before any of those had started. And I expect that trend will just continue because Congress likes spending money on defense. It's an easy sell to their constituents, and it makes their constituents money because a lot of it gets diverted back to their districts where defense contractors have lots of jobs. And so when we vote on the defense budget, it's not always about national security. Sometimes it's about economic security, especially for the congressionals who have big defense contractor presences in their districts. And of course, the defense contractors are smart, right? They subcontract it to as many places as possible so that a lot of members of Congress, if not the majority, will stand to benefit from a growing defense budget. So I think that's part of it. Psychologically, I think there was a psychological impact of 9/11 on the viewers or on the American people. I mean, seeing a horrific attack carried out on your soil in real time at a time when that wasn't the norm. You know, now we're used to seeing video clips from Ukraine or from the war in Gaza. We're used to seeing tons of images just flood the internet of combat that's going on. But that was new. That didn't exist back then. That was still a relatively new thing. And so seeing it in real time, I think, did have a serious and lasting psychological impact on the American public, which convinced them, at least initially, that the enormously increased spending and resources we were diverting to our defense, intelligence, and military establishment was a good investment. There wasn't much debate about that, at least at the outset. Of course, there were dissenters. There were people who opposed it, but they were a minority at first. The first few years, and I think I would define that at least in the first five after 9/11, it was pretty clear that the American public felt like that they were doing the right thing. And that isn't to justify the Iraq invasion by saying, well, we should be forgiven for that because we made decisions under duress. That's not my point. My point is simply saying that the American public, you know, we're human beings, and there was a very real psychological impact from 9/11, and that motivated the set of behaviors and decisions that we made for the next several years. And that's just a fact. I mean, that's just how it is. So the question then becomes, you know, as we look forward, how are we going to change over time? I mean, will we continue to grow and increase the military and defense budget and spend enormous sums of resources when we're not at war? We're not in a war right now. Of course, there's war on the doorstep of Europe, and we're almost at war in the Middle East. I don't know if you've been following combat operations in that theater, but about 3 months ago, one of the commanders gave an interview from one of the carrier strike groups are there, and they mentioned that they had, during their last deployment, which had been, I think that last rotation was 2 months, they had carried out over 800 attacks against Houthi targets on the coast of Yemen. And that's a huge number. So we kind of are at war, really, in the Middle East. It may be an undeclared war, but that's a pretty high level of operations, and that's a lot of targets to hit. So I guess my question going forward is, as we think about 9/11, we always remember, you know, the folks who were killed and the shock that it brought to the United States. But it's also brought us lasting changes that we haven't managed to stop yet. You know, the Patriot Act is still in force. The organizations that we created to combat the threat that we saw then are still growing. And even though that threat has now been vanquished, and we seem to not know how to get rid of those organizations, we seem to not know how, or rather, maybe instead of that, I should say, we just don't have the political will right now to do that. And I wonder every year how much longer it's going to go on and how much longer it'll be until we do figure out that we need to do that, because the threat has been dealt with and that those resources will be better spent elsewhere. I'm all in favor, of course, of adequately funding the military. My son's a member of it. No one who has a loved one, especially a child who's serving in the armed forces, wants them to be under-resourced. But what we've got today is a situation where they're over-resourced, and the overage is just being misspent in ways that don't further the U.S. Security interests. And so that's something I hope to see changed in the years that follow. This year, of course, we're smack in the middle of a presidential election. I'm recording this before the presidential debate, and then the only one scheduled between Harris and Trump. So I would expect to hear at least a couple of instances of blaming, you know, being thrown back and forth between the two candidates. I doubt at all we'll hear any depth or any serious discussion about why it took so long to destroy Al-Qaeda, why it cost so much, and what we're going to do in the future. And those are topics, I guess, for a different segment here, as we're already, you know, past the half hour mark. But I just wanted to share those kind of thoughts as we look back in what we've seen and how the 9/11 changed America and how we're still dealing with those changes as we commemorate the loss, to think about, you know, what the way ahead is going to be and how we're going to chart that path in the future. But I will do a separate show on that in the future. I just wanted to throw that out there and get folks thinking. Use that gray matter, get that neural stimulation going, because it'll take a collective effort. One person's not going to be able to do it. A president's not going to be able to do it by themselves. Unless you get Congress on board, it's not going to happen. So change is not going to come just from a president. It doesn't matter if it's Trump or Harris. They're not going to be able to change it by themselves. The change will require a lasting and solid majority of the American public, and that will pressure their congressional reps to make changes. And I know that's going to take a long time, but that's the only way that it's going to get done. So thanks for listening, and I hope everyone has a great day.